You can blame my co-author, Brian Platt, for that title. You can see he's the lead author here. He was originally supposed to come give this talk. He's been fighting an illness now for a little while, and good news is he's probably got a handle on it, but the bad news is he wasn't allowed to travel by his doctor, so he asked me to come up from Kansas. And Greg Ludvigsen is also at the Geological Survey, and Joe Thomason is an emeritus professor with Fort Hays University in western Kansas. And it was really Joe that kind of turned us on to this locality that I'm going to describe to you. But the overall kind of arching thrust of the research is to understand and better characterize the Ogallala Formation. I'll describe why that is in just a second. The other thing I want to warn you about is I'm originally from Atlanta, and I pronounce soil kind of weirdly, and I got a lot of weird looks when I moved to Kansas 13 years ago. People are like, "Are you saying soil?" And I'm like, "Yeah, soul." So if you hear that, that's what that is. I'm not saying soul. So I want to acknowledge some of our co-conspirators here, Andrew Smaller with KU, the late Larry Martin, who helped us with some fossil identification of vertebrate remains. And there's a host of students and in addition to landowners in this particular area in western Kansas near Lake Scott Park, Lake Scott State Park, and then some generous funding from NSF, the KGS, and also the Kansas Water Office. So what is this deal with the Ogallala? The Ogallala Formation, this blue here is the outline of the formation itself, underlies much of the High Plains region. It's composed of discontinuous beds of conglomerates, sandstones, and calcareous paleosols. The time range for the deposition of the Ogallala is thought to be somewhere in the middle Miocene, perhaps 16 million years ago, up into maybe the earliest Pliocene, somewhere around 5 million years ago. And that's based on North American mammal assemblages. Paleontologists through the years have basically chronologized the Cenozoic period into a series of mammal ages. So when we see a certain type of mammal, we know that we're probably within this age range here. And a lot of that's essentially ground truth based on dating of volcanic deposits. And it just so happens during this time interval, we had multiple and continuous eruptions of on the Snake River Plain of Yellowstone-type eruptions. And so these are also available for dating of these sediments. The depositional history is thought to be similar to this graphic here, which is actually down in Texas and New Mexico. But you have uplift of the Rocky Mountains during the Laramide Orogeny, which is started sometime around 45 million years ago. And then as that process continued, there were a series of valleys that were cut into the Cretaceous bedrock, and that these valleys were eventually filled and then overtopped. And that's why we have that kind of pancake shape. And it's not as flat as a pancake. I shouldn't have said that. But this sort of, you know, High Plains flat horizon there. Of course, the reason why we're most interested in it is one of the world's largest freshwater aquifers. It accounts for about 30% of all groundwater withdrawals in the U.S. And then this figure is from McGuire 2009. He's with the USGS, and it's documenting the drop in water levels compared to pre-development, which in most places in the High Plains was sometime around the 1940s. So, and for instance, our study area is right here in western Kansas, and you can see some of these big red blots there. Water levels in some of those areas have dropped 200-300 feet. And here is a graphic showing that. This is the Haskell County Index well in western Kansas. And these are water levels from 2007 to 2012. You can see this is basically during the watering portion of the year, and then recovery and watering and recovery, and water levels over time are just dropping because withdrawal is exceeding recharge, obviously. So part of the reason why we focused on this area here in Scott County, or I'll show you a figure in a second, it's Ladder Creek Canyon. It's a number of sites that we've been looking at to help try and characterize the Ogallala Aquifer. Everything from the geochronology, the timing of deposition, to the actual composition of the aquifer itself. Because despite the fact that we've punctured this thing thousands and thousands of times and been drawing all this water out of it, there's really little work that's been done on basic lithology, even paleontology. And part of the reason, it wouldn't be a good aquifer if it was widely exposed and those things were readily available for examination. So it took a concerted effort of collecting cores and a drilling program that we started at the KGS, and that's what these sites basically mark here, to start to try and look at that aquifer in the subsurface. So one of those sites is Ladder Creek Canyon, and at that site, we actually have very good exposures of the upper portion of the Ogallala Aquifer. And since my original training is in trace fossils, and I noticed many trace fossils, this was a really exciting site to work at. So while the drillers were doing their work, I was running around in the canyon like a crazy person. So we're going to relate the macromorphological features of these calcretes in these paleosols to the paleopedology, the ancient soil-forming processes, and then the paleoacknology, whereas Al was talking about neoacknology, I'm going to be focused on paleoacknology. And with special interest in the traces that we've found that we've able to attribute perhaps to hymenopterans. So here's Ladder Creek Canyon. The blue here, or the green, I should say, are exposures of the Ogallala Formation in the canyon walls. Those yellow dots are some of our field sites. So the basic stratigraphy within the canyon wall, this is Devil's Backbone Road Cut. This was one of particular interest because it was more or less recent road cut. I think it was done within the last 100 years, I should say. There was a railroad track that kind of ran along that ledge right there, and then they later leveled it even further for the road. But it's really in those places that we see a very good fresh cut of the stratigraphy. So the first lithostratigraphic, or this is just purely based on lithology of this unit, not really looking at pedology, are these massive decrossbedded sandstones. There's not a whole lot of crossbedding that's evident because most of it's been disturbed by either biological processes or purely soil processes. So they become massive. And these are coarse to conglomeratic and grain-sized, and they represent likely relatively high-energy fluvial systems. And then interbedded with those are these reddish-tan silty sandstones. They're pretty friable. They come apart very easily. In areas where there's not a lot of calcrete, a lot of calcite precipitated, we see this angular, blocky to prismatic structure, and you can kind of see that in here. There's even much larger ones that are in some areas. And we interpret these as pedogenically modified proximal overbank deposits. These are probably nearer to the stream source. And we see these as multiple stacked paleosols in some areas. There's also a brown claystone. This is composed of angular blocky structure. Rhizoliths are readily apparent. There's a rhizolith there and one right there. We interpret these as pedogenically modified distal overbank deposits, so finer grain or abandoned channel clay plugs. And then finally, we have this pretty laterally persistent gray conglomerate. It contains very large diameter burrows or tubes, without being too interpretive about it. And you can see those right in here. There's a series of them there. And this is, again, is probably a high-energy environment, fluvial. Okay, so imprinted on top of that is the calcrete morphology. And so here's our lithology here. Here's the calcrete morphology. So I'll go into some of these different types of calcrete. So the first, and these are going to be highlighted in yellow depending on where they're at in our stratigraphy here. These are fenestral stringers. They're 1 to 10 centimeters thick. They're typically associated with the brown clay stones. In thin section, the blue here are the calcite portion of the thin section. And then around the calcite, you can see these concentric rings. Those rings are composed of clay particles. I'll talk about how we interpret these in just a second. There I am for scale, and about 60 pounds heavier. And so these are honeycomb calcretes. This is part of the reason why I was first attracted to this area. You know, we were doing the drilling in the area. A colleague of mine, Joe Thomason, co-author on here, he's a grass seed specialist, and he's created a biochronology of the high plains using grass seeds. And he said, oh yeah, I go to these things in some areas I can, where they're a little more powdery and not quite cemented, I find these pockets of grass seeds. He says, I think they're probably put there by arthropods or something. And then when I went out there, I'm like, oh my God, they're ant nests. And I'll show some much better pictures of it. But I mean, it was just strikingly obvious to me that they were ant nests. But what ends up happening is a lot of the ant nests, the calcite growth in the calcretes has essentially, it's expansive, and it has gone beyond the boundaries of the ant nest themselves and begin to connect with each other and create this kind of, I don't know, it reminds me of a Gothic candelabra or something in an old church. And in fact, when people saw these, they kind of thought that this structure here was a precipitation product of a calcrete itself, as opposed to filling in vugs and whatnot. We'll talk about more about this in just a second. Oh, this is what I saw when I first arrived, in these very nice, you see they're linear here. We'll see some close-up pictures soon. But these honeycomb calcretes are most closely associated with the red silty sands. We also have massive to platy calcretes. And these have sharp, irregular basal contacts, and they're tens of centimeters to meters thick, and they're pretty laterally continuous. And what was funny was when Brian and I were out there, and we would look at these calcretes, and we were finding these little, at first, if you look at my notes, I called them little brown nodules. And I thought, wow, these really weird little kind of clay, sandy nodules. What in the world is that? What that was is the original soil matrix. And it had been completely encapsulized by the growth of the calcrete. So it was really what was basically just left over after this huge mass of calcrete developed. Not nodules in any kind of classic sense. These are associated with and overlie the red silty sandstones and the honeycomb calcretes. You can see some of these structures, the candelabra structures in there. They're not as well solidified with the calcite. In addition, there are also interbedded layers of laminar and poizolitic calcretes. Saw a few of those. And then finally, at the very top, we have these prismatic calcretes. They're up to a few meters, or up to a meter or so thick. They overlie the red silty sandstone. You can see the prismatic structures in there. They tend to cap the ridges in the area. They're laterally continuous, and we're still trying to understand what they are telling us. Okay, so now I'm going to relate the specific ichnology to the different lithologies and the different calcrete structures. So the first one would be calcareous tubules. These are associated with the red silty sandstones. They're pretty small in diameter. These are even smaller ones. These are around a millimeter in diameter. These are associated with our fenestral stringers and also with the honeycomb calcrete. Of course, we're interpreting these as likely being rhizoliths. And you can see some organic matter is preserved within the tubule structures. And we have both. We have these both preserved as in epirelief as a solid structure, but also in this hyperrelief here where It is, the calcrete is grown around it. So this is the third type of trace fossil that we identified. It's a horizontal to subvertical tube with a rounded termination. I want to tell you how this works for us as geologists and paleontologists. I got accused one time at a meeting at the university, you're a trace fossil expert. You look at funny shaped rocks and call them things. And I'm like, yes, I do. The thing is, when you're in the field and you spend days and days in the field, you start to see patterns. And you start to see the same funny-shaped rock over and over again. And that funny-shaped rock is associated with the same stratigraphic interval. It's associated with the same another group of funny-shaped rocks, same kind of conditions. And what we try to do is we try to build our case that we're actually seeing these same patterns. They're not just randomly created nodules or concretions, things of that kind. So this type 3, I say that so you keep in mind that we have many examples of these. And Brian and I are pretty conservative when it comes to that. We really try to make sure that we have a strong case. So these type 3 horizontal to subhorizontal tubes, they're upwards of 2 centimeters in diameter. We find them in the red silty sandstones. Here's another example here. And these are actually very similar to experiments that were conducted by our fellow graduate student at the time, Dan Embry, who was looking at amphispanians. And these are the burrows that amphispanians create. These are legless reptiles. They're not snakes. They're more closely related to lizards. They're obligate fossorial animals. They live in the soil exclusively. And this is a cast of the burrows that were being produced by these amphispanians, and we think ours are very similar. We also have these subhorizontal tubes with internal meniscae. Meniscae is a backfilling structure. It just means lunar-shaped or lunate. These are 1 to 3 centimeters in diameter. They're associated with coarse sandstones, and some of them weather in relief, and we interpret these as backfilling by soil arthropods. And you can see the meniscae right there, and then that one you really can't see, but I've kind of outlined the borders of it. And these are very, so these are, I think Al showed us a figure similar to this. These are burrowing beetle larvae in a controlled tank, and you can see how their backfilling creates these lunate structures, the meniscae. We have vertically compressed, subhorizontal to subvertical sinuous and helical tubes. It's kind of hard to see how helical or sinuous these things are in a two-dimensional picture that we have there. But these are associated with the honeycomb calcretes. And we think these are most similar. There's another one there that's still an outcrop. And we think these are very similar to some of the work that Dan's been doing with burrowing scorpions and vinegroons and other animals like that that generally have arthropods that have generally have a flat body plan. Hey, if you didn't know what a scorpion looks like, that's what one looks like. Type 6, these are variable diameter subhorizontal tubes with enlarged and rounded terminations. Here's one in the outcrop, and you can kind of see it there a little bit. There seems to be sort of, it almost looks like a pretzel or a dog treat to me, and it kind of looks like that. It looks like the burrow, the tube, has been wrapped around itself, and it's kind of hard to see in the picture here. Everyone's seen those rawhide bones where they tie the ends with themselves? Okay, that's what I'm talking about. And one of the traces that we're familiar with that modern organisms make that we think are similar are these. These are produced by very large millipedes. This is work that Dan Embry, again, out of the University of Ohio, has been doing. And there, if you don't know what a millipede looks like. We also have these vertical to sub-horizontal large diameter tubes. These are associated with the red silty sandstones, and this is very difficult to see, so I've outlined it there. There's the opening there. It's facing the outcrop. It's been broken off, and that goes up into the outcrop at that angle. Here's another one, and I'll go ahead and highlight it. That one's very large, and we are interpreting these as likely mammal burrows. And then here are some smaller diameter but interconnected networks of tubes. They're associated with the platy and massive calcretes, but also the conglomerates. Many of these have bulbous terminations associated with them. Some of them also have collections of seeds and other material when we see them cut, see them in cross section. And if they're very highly cemented with the calcrete, generally the calcrete seems to push everything else out of the way. But in some instances where they're not as well cemented, we can actually see some material that's preserved on the inside. Of course, these look very similar to small ground mammal burrows, probably ground squirrels or gophers of some kind. That's getting annoying. There's a gopher. Okay, the ninth type are these flask-shaped traces. They have a smooth wall associated with them. Just a couple of them have a spiral cap at the top. Many of them have what appears to be a portion of a tunnel still attached to them. We have hundreds of these. Here's an example from the outcrop. You can see them. This outcrop is composed of almost nothing but these tiny little cells. Intensely bioturbated surfaces or intervals of the red silty sand and massive calcretes. And again, you can see them cropping out here. They seem to be grouped in huge clusters. We see a lot of these bulges that come down from into the red silty, like from this area right in here, and there just seems to be masses and masses of them. So what we suspect is we're looking at is a nest with a lot of the individual cells attached to that nest. There's highlighted some of them. And then a few of them are not individuals, but they're actually conjoined, and we have many examples of that. And this would be similar to a trace fossil called Celicolichnus. In general, we call a single one would be called Celiforma. That's the trace fossil name. We give trace fossils names just like we give everything names. And this is an example here of a modern ground nesting bee creating a nest that has multiple cells attached like that. This is actually a trace fossil from South America, from Paraguay, a very similar structure to the modern ones. I think that's Miocene as well. Here's some cross-section of those cells. You can see the clay lining here, and then you can kind of see the cap up in here. This is a portion of the burrow that's still connected. And then there's a modern one, and there's a bee. You didn't know what a bee looked like. Okay, so type 10, these are vertical to helical tubes connecting horizontal pancake-shaped chambers. These are extremely abundant in the red silty sand and at the base of, or they're basically creating the honeycomb calcretes. Here's an instance where they're not as well cemented. It almost looks like a kid went with a piece of white chalk and drew it on the red sandstone, but these are the types of things that my colleague Joe Thomason are targeting, because it's very easy to pick those out with a knife, and if it's a hard cemented lump of rock, it's not as easy. But these are everywhere, and in fact, these have been everywhere in the Ogallala I've looked. Here's some of the chambers. These are the flat kind of pancake shape that we've pulled out of the outcrop. They range from sort of teardrop shaped up to these very large, almost kidney-shaped structures here. It always appears like in this particular type, the chamber, if that's what it is connected at the edge by a vertical shaft. And these are nearly identical to modern harvester ant nest structures, and you can see these range from teardrop shaped up to kidney and a little bit more irregular shaped, and then the shafts are always connected at the edge. This is Walt Schinkel, and this is a Florida harvester ant nest that he has cast. Walt does a lot of work. He casts in plaster and aluminum, depending on what type of analysis he's going to do later on, whether he's looking at the architecture or whether he's looking at position of the different, the ants and the queen and drones and what have you. If they want to see where they're at in the nest, they might cast in plaster so they can later dissolve the plaster and then count the ants that are there. One of the things to note from this picture here, though, is that there are a couple things going on with this nest in particular. We've recently cast a western harvester ant nest in western Kansas, and we seem to have the same basic architecture going on. We have this big, huge mass of chambers that are interconnected and closely spaced at the top, and then with depth, we have these helical shafts, and then pancake sort of shaped chambers coming off the helix. Here is a picture from the outcrop, and then this is a cast that Walt produced. Just some more images here, kind of making the point. And then the last type, I think, type 10, this is the last picture I've got of these. These are the pancake shaped chambers towards the top of the base of the calcretes here. There's just masses and masses of them. So the relationship between the calcretes and the trace fossils. There are no trace fossils that were identified from the prismatic calcretes. Let's see. I think I talked about what most of these were as I went through there. What I wanted to emphasize here, again, me for scale, is we see this the red sandy paleosol, and then this mass of calcrete above it, and then another one, and then another mass of calcrete. And what I think the best way to interpret that is these calcretes, are the emplacement of them, are actually being controlled by the volume of nest that's present, at least in the original soil. And then we see the shafts descending from there. And this probably is telling us something about the original position of the paleo surface of these soils. The other thing that's really interesting about the honeycomb calcrete is that it's not just the nest, and I'm kind of highlighting portions of it, but and there's some of those red nodules I was telling you about that aren't nodules, they're the original soil matrix that are completely enclosed by the calcite. So we have probably an original prismatic soil structure with ant nests and other biotically generated structures within there. Those are those voids are filled with calcite later, and then once that material, the sand that isn't encapsulated by the calcite weathers away, we're left with sort of these honeycomb structures that have been identified. There's one there. And the traces represent construction of the vadose zone based on the preference of the different trace makers. I'm kind of running out of time here. But one thing I did want to talk about really quick was when we first started working out here, we saw the harvester ant nest and we saw a lot of calcrete. And if you put those things together in a modern soil environment, the interpretation that you would take away from that would be these are probably arid conditions when these soils were first produced. I'm not completely convinced by that. And I think the vast majority of the carbonate that you're seeing in the system was there, but these structures that are being produced in the calcrete, the precipitation of it, the massive precipitation, is probably a much later phenomenon. And I think it has more to do with the formation of the canyon itself and the flow of groundwater into the canyon and then those canyon walls being able to dry out and precipitate the calcite rather than it being, these massive layers of calcite throughout the entire High Plains area. Because if you look at driller's logs, they'll talk about hitting one of these every now and then. We tried to drill through this. We couldn't do it. So what I'd want to do now is look at driller's logs as we move away from the canyon wall to see if we encounter less and less of these calcrete formations. But in any event, that's the end of my story, and I really appreciate everybody paying attention. Thank you.
All right, thanks, John.